Horticulturalist, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsley at horticulture.com talking to Gib Strange. So I know you wanted structure today, and I feel particularly unstructured. Like I think it's partly because I've been working on a completely unrelated piece, which I probably shouldn't even say what it is because we might get pulled into it. But it's about Hollywood more than anything.
Well, I was thinking we could talk about Neurodeviant. Does that jive with?
Good idea. Yeah. I mean, that was the point of having these meetings, talk through right. That, but also now Notes from Underground, Notes from Uncanny Valley. Have you read Notes from Underground, by the way?
Yes.
Was it did it influence you?
No, not really.
Thinking I see the influences, but it just occurred to me that it's such a prototypical work, I think.
Yeah, certainly I wasn't thinking about it when I was writing it, except in the sense of like that kind of outsider archetype that became common in literature.
Yeah.
Later in Camus too. I mean, I read Notes from the Underground when I was a teenager, and I guess I'm just saying I wasn't consciously aware of any. I wasn't beyond that, you know. But but I like kind of playing off of that with the title.
So that was conscious.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Replacing the Underground with the Uncanny Valley.
Right. Yeah, well, Pauline Kael described Taxi Driver as a raw tabloid version of Notes from Underground. So there's a lineage, you could say, between, well, a whole bunch of different works. As you say, Camus, The Outsider, which I probably read it before Notes from Underground, almost certainly, actually, because I got into Dostoevsky in my very early 20s, and I read Camus when I was still a teenager. I was about 18, 19. Mm. Of course, I saw Taxi Driver long before that when I was 15 or something. I'd say it's been a very, very central, that archetype, if you like, of the unsympathetic, alienated outsider.
Right.
And of course, you could say that not Neurodeviant as a book, but the idea of the Neurodeviant at least is kind of the latest iteration of that. I mean, the autist was the alienated, unsympathetic outsider.
You say unsympathetic, is that what you said?
Yeah. I mean, not to me, obviously, that's the whole point.
Right, it seems it's only sympathetic to other alienated, unsympathetic outsiders, which there seems to be more and more of, right?
Yeah, which presents a bit of a paradox there, which feels like there's something paradoxical about works of art that become popular depicting the unsympathetic, alienated outsider, because that's sort of paradoxical, because like Travis Bickle is hugely popular. He can't get laid and he can't make friends, but he's an icon, you know, to millions of people.
Sure.
So what is that? It's like when the culture takes something and you could say exploits it, but anyway, it packages it in such a way that it actually becomes appealing and sympathetic. So if it wasn't sympathetic, nobody would appreciate the work. But I mean, my subconscious, the attraction or the appeal of those works that became conscious to me very early on was the way that art can make the unsympathetic sympathetic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess Frank Booth in Blue Velvet was, to me, that was like the apotheosis of that, because he's not meant to be sympathetic, really. He's the heavy. He's no longer the central figure. He's actually the adverse figure. Mm-hmm. But he's very sympathetic, I found. I found myself loving Frank Booth.
An anti-villain.
Yeah.
What is it, do you think? That's an interesting example to go into. Where do you feel the most sympathy with him? Because it's sort of Kyle MacLachlan's connection to him. It seems like it's the moment where, what's Kyle MacLachlan's name?
Jeffrey
sees Frank in himself. That connection happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that where, is that kind of the key to, I think maybe when you see him crying in the club when he's watching her sing.
Yeah, that was what I was thinking.
Yeah, right. That's kind of the moment where.
I think once the correlation becomes clear between his savagery and his pathology and his suffering, I quoted in Blood Poets, I was just rereading my thing on Blue Velvet, and I quoted Mary Shelley, the monster saying, "Misery made me a fiend, make me happy and I'll be virtuous." That's very clear with Frank, is that he's only as dangerous and as vicious as he is, you know, miserable.
Mm-hmm.
So then it's hard not to see all of his violence, his brutality as expressions of misery.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they're very profound and shocking, so therefore it communicates how much he's suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this came up because I was talking about the scene in my book where I call the narrator, it's a third person, maybe that's associative, where he's asked to take a couple's photograph, and I had it originally written where it occurs to him to run off with the camera, and that Darren Westland, I think, just thought, maybe at that moment, he kind of came off like an asshole. And then we kind of had this idea about sympathetic. And I also have this vague memory of Gary Height talking about it in your podcast, about the idea of in existential literature of that archetype. And I think he was kind of, I mean, it's vague, but I can't remember quite, but something that, about, existentialism being like the big product of the 20th century, and that outsider figure kind of being sold to in the culture.
Mm. Right. Well, I don't remember the conversation. It'd be interesting to hear it back, but yeah, that was what I was. That was the same idea that I was bringing up just a moment ago, the sort of paradox of the contradiction of that. Why would a culture raise up a figure that is antithetical to its, its values in that way? Because it's controlled opposition.
Mm-hmm.
But bringing it back to the specifics, your third person avatar of yourself, your fictional version of yourself. And I think it's good for a writer to remain ambiguous about that to some degree without mystifying or anything. And it does become, like I've written, fictionalized versions of my life to the point that there are areas where I'm not sure now, because I definitely did try and do this. I added elements, like I added me meeting Clint Eastwood in Carmel while I was traveling, as part of, you know, a fictionalized autobiography. And I didn't end up wondering, did I actually meet Clint Eastwood? But it did become quite real to me, that scene, that where I would almost felt like I had a memory of it. And there were certainly other things that I have made up and I'm no longer sure. Smaller, more minor things, like, did I actually embellish that feat, that detail, or was that real? So there is something inevitable, I think, about what you're doing with Notes from Uncanny Valley, which is your narrativizing your experiences. But anyway, that was all just a really kind of a preamble, because I wanted to ask about the specifics with that scene and the tourists and the camera. The desire to run away with the camera, well, how was that an accurate representation as you remember it now, or was that an embellishment?
Yeah, it was, and I think they just to be clear, like, the idea was not to sell the camera later for money, but to look at their pictures that are already on the camera, you know.
Yeah,
that was the incentive, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that was in there. I certainly don't remember ever having the impression that you just wanted to steal. It was
more about voyeurism than than
crime, yeah, or just being aggressive even. But wasn't it also about, do you know the Edgar Allan Poe story called The Imp of the Perverse?
No, I don't think so.
So that's about how there's something in us that desires to act in inverse ratio to how rational the action is. As in, we have an idea and we know that this is a bad idea, and precisely because we know it's a bad idea, something in us wants to do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a word that kept coming up when I was working on the summary copy thing, perverse, you know. Yeah, so what do you think that's about?
Well, I think what's coming to mind now, and it's been a while since I thought about the story, and it's something that I have been aware of in myself for a long time. The most obvious example is on a bridge or a train platform, thinking, wanting to jump in front of the train, not because I want to get killed, but just because I don't want to, right? There's something comes up, and then the resistance to it makes it stronger, right? Because it's like, don't think about hippopotamuses. Well, that makes you think about hippopotamuses. So I've always been aware of that, but I'm wondering now how much it relates to the whole thing of taboo and social control, and how, you know, when you create a taboo, you also create a corresponding desire in people to break it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Because it's, well, because of this tension between being part of a collective and wanting to be separate from it and be an individual. So we reconcile that tension because we have to be both separate and part of it. We reconcile it by defining ourselves against the collective in some way. Like the negative identities. That way we're both part of it and not part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So then that's taboo breaking as well. And that would relate to the outsider also.
Mm-hmm.
To some degree anyway.
Monoculture versus diversity.
Yeah, it's right. So this thing of monoculture as well, and how that's become, because that wasn't, that's a recent thing. It's becoming more and more homogenize the culture, so presumably the desire to be an individual is becoming stronger and stronger as well, which seems to be true with transgender and what have you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's all perverse in that regard, which is why figures like Travis or Notes from Underground or your protagonist or even Frank Booth are sympathetic, I think, because I forgot actually why I was going to say they were, funnily enough, but anyway, that's why. Whatever I said before is why.
Yeah, well, like in that example of that scene where he's taking a picture of the couple, you know, he's single, right? Like, so you know, he's alone. Yeah. So there's, you have to have sympathy for, you know, everybody knows what it's like to be single and to be taking a picture of a couple in some sense, right?
True. But I think it relates to a kind of awareness. I think what I was groping towards there was this, that the adversarial figure is aware of something that the non-adversarial figure isn't.
Mm.
I mean, that's certainly what makes these characters appealing, is that they're, it's not that they're too good to join society, but they're too, well, it depends actually, and because they vary a lot. Certainly they're too damaged, but I think because they're damaged, they're also too aware of something, of the hypocritical nature of society.
Yeah, they know something the couple doesn't, or...
And you could even say that what makes the society hypocritical is it that it doesn't hold a space for its damaged.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, yeah. Doesn't really have space for the individual, period.
No. No, so that's, I guess that's what I mean. They're aware of the paradox and the hypocrisy of society, which is saying be an individual in order to be part of this society. Yeah, we'll embrace you as an individual if you conform. So that's an inherent lie and a paradox.
Makes me think of... I'm gonna be different, like all my different friends. There's sort of a marketed, you know, there's like socially acceptable forms of rebellion, right? That's a big part of the youth culture always, you know.
Yeah, well, and that brings back to the controlled opposition, doesn't it? Because I mean, there's always going to be individuals who are closer to being individuals, and so they won't swallow the hypocrisy, they won't fall for it, and they won't conform and be different in the ways that are, you know, being marketed to them. And so for them, you have to create a rebellion. The culture has to create a rebellion.
Yeah. What does that look like? What would be a good example?
Well, like the counterculture.
Mm-hmm.
Like the counterculture as PSYOP, that whole thing.
Right.
Like those were all dropouts, and they're probably, a lot of them were genuinely seeing the hypocrisy of society and genuinely trying to follow their own orientation, but they also, social animals, they also needed to be part, feel like they were part of something, so they were easy prey for a, you know, a state created counterfeit. So then, I mean, the kind of works we're talking about that were raised up by the culture, presumably there was something in them that was useful to the culture. I mean, actually, the really obvious example we're not using here is Salinger, The Catcher in the Rye.
Oh, yeah.
Because that was massive influential, and that was about that character as well, the alienated outsider.
Yeah, kind of the ultimate. I mean, Holden Caulfield, we all know that name more so than any of the previous outsider figures, right?
I think it's particularly US. Like, I didn't grow up being aware of Holden Caulfield.
Yeah, it's sort of a rite of passage in America to turn 16 and read Catcher in the Rye.
Right. So yeah, that's got to be something. Got to be something powerful behind that. I'd say beside the zeitgeist, or at least the zeitgeist is not what we think it is, as in just this wholly organic thing, like nature.
We met up in South America, where I knew our murders would go unsolved, if not entirely unnoticed. Tales told by dead men are always worth hearing, so let's start from the beginning.
I got it straight from the source. Went in bed on the wrong horse. Called me up for a couple of bucks. Last time he loaned money, he went and bought a Mexican divorce.
To the meta, which is you and I writing, trying to find the bridge between fiction and non-fiction, or the synthesis of the two perhaps, and at the same time and even in the same sort of breath, or this with the same, it's the same agenda in a way, to reach an audience, you know, to even find a publisher at this point. So I find many publishers, it's whatever, let's just say currently, you know, the things we're working on are difficult to even place, much less reach an audience. So then it's like, is there a way to make our expression of the alienated, unsympathetic outsider within us, to speak for that part and to communicate what it sees, is there a way to make it communicable to loads of people? Mm. And if so, would that invalidate it? And then, so, you know, is it really desirable? I suppose is the question. Right?
Because success equals failure, could equal failure.
Yeah, if we want to reach the people who really will receive it, they would be people who really are outsiders. So then they wouldn't be reachable through the usual channels, and in fact, they would even perhaps distrust something that was successful.
That's true. Yeah, right. Well, that's like when you're young and it's the, you know, the band that gets really big, but you were into them first, and
yeah,
it becomes difficult to trust them. I mean, that usually happens because then their material is less relatable because their experience of life is different than yours because they're now famous and rich.
Yeah, and getting laid constantly.
Right. But let's figure out just the first half of the question of if you could even, how did you put market to, if you could even
reach a more large audience.
Right. As I was thinking, I mean, we had a culture and then we had a counterculture, so it bifurcated in the 60s. And then from there, you know, a certain amount of the counterculture was just absorbed back into the culture. I was thinking about like Mad Men, where you had, you know, you could kind of, you got to like kind of, I feel like a lot of big part of the fascination with that show, I was late to the game with it, was seeing the inner workings of getting inside the mind of people who get inside the minds of the people, you know, in advertising, which is kind of what we're talking about, right? Like, 'cause we're talking about how do you find a publisher and how do you sell it to the publisher first, market and all this. But anyway, like the counterculture, a part of it also continued to just bifurcate, right? And like I have that part in my book where talking about, you know, like in the 90s, cable, you had like, you know, 300 channels. So advertising was happening on a more individual level. And in a way that like the remote control was the precursor to the computer mouse, right? Because that would lead to an even more individually targeted market. I mean, right down to your individual tastes where your feed is completely self-curated and advertisers, you know, the level of diversity at that point where everybody has a very specific personal taste that can be catered to.
By corporations who mass produce.
Right.
There's a paradox in that too.
Corporations who mass produce, but must be trying to understand. I mean, you can break them down into smaller and smaller sub-demographics, but, you know, like you said, you've got the transgender and, you know, a lot of the neurodiversity. And so there's more of a wider array, you know, variety of, you can't just point to like the middle-aged housewife demographic the way the 50s or 60s, you know. And especially because youth culture is something that is so targeted, because that's where people are forming their sense of identity. And are have more time because they're not working all the time. They're not adults yet, and they have some income that they can, or they have some money, maybe their parents' money to spend. So
yeah, so it's like the culture is replicating, or the counterculture, whatever. Like you said, increased bifurcation. So there's more and more subdivisions now.
Right.
Whereas before, if you imagine in the 50s, there was such this oppressive stereotype that was supposed to be one size fits all practically. Even if you're homosexual, you couldn't, you know, like even something as basic as that, as a deviation as that, and you were outside the, you know, the club. So then there would have been this wilderness in which people really had to just find their own, you know, orientation, so to speak, culturally, socially, sexually, you name it, relative freedom as compared to now, where no matter how specific your deviations are, there's probably already a market been carved out for it.
Yeah, right. And on, you know, like the level of sexuality, the what sexual behaviors that would have been repressed 30 years ago are now there's quite a vast fetish menu to sort of appropriate your sense of sexual identity from, you know, via porno and
online dating and So I mean, this is kind of a departure. It's right after what you just said, but we're going in an unexpected direction now, because recently I mean after I got back from Finland, because of things that went on in the retreat, partially, I felt like I wanted to take a new departure in terms of my, you know, communications and whatnot, my output, and that I wanted it to center around maternal psychic enmeshment, as I call it, mother bondage. You call it mother bondage. As soon as you search for that online, all you get is pornographic images, which is kind of the point that I'm getting to. But anyway, I had this thought, and this is a thought I've had some years back. I was thinking about a book I could write called The End of Sex, Everything You Want to Know About Marriage But Were Afraid to Ask, it being the subject of maternal psychic enmeshment and how it hijacks our libido and prevents us from actually having a healthy sexual relationship with a woman. It's a particularly male thing. Anyway, so I was thinking that I felt confident enough in my own life now to share some of my experience around this, because it's pretty extensive. And the reason I'm bringing it up now is that with all these little niche and subcategories and all the rest of it, this is not something that's being talked about. This isn't something that's being offered to people. It's, you know, some sort of orientation around what happens when you're psychically enmeshed with your mother in ways that aren't obvious, like Norman Bates or flaming homosexuals, but still to the point that you can't sustain or even enter into a sexual relationship with a woman. Like, this is so prevalent now, in my opinion, and yet it's not, there's nothing out there. Google is not going to give you an algorithm for this. It's not going to, there's going to be no ads popping up. The opposite, right? This is something that's a closely guarded secret, you could say, and yet is of massive relevance to, well, yeah, millions of men.
Yeah.
So I just thought it was kind of, it was interesting. It just came up organically with what you were talking about, because here's an example of something that could be widely successful in theory, and that wouldn't be invalidating it.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because then you're pointing to a way to gauge whether or not that, a way to gauge the success of success being successful or something, you know, that's not where it wouldn't render it. Suspect or,
it would almost be the reverse, because it would be a way to test out how correct that particular diagnosis is, based on how much people responded to it. Of course, there is the problem that people don't want to think about it or recognize it, much less admit to it. So it wouldn't. Yeah.
Particularly, I mean, I guess we could say that that has been tested out on the other side, right? Could we say that there are examples of culture that I mean, it's probably not going to be an accurate equivalent to what your project is, but for something where women are allowed to examine their daddy issues. I'm just thinking men are more uncomfortable with going there than...
They certainly are, yeah, yeah. I don't think it's that widespread, women acknowledging father issues or... I mean, obviously the whole Freudian, you know, subculture or the, you know, pop psychology is, yeah, it's come and gone and come back again. It's definitely part of our culture. Yeah.
But isn't, like... Through scrolling through countless online dating profiles, I've noticed that the amount of women advertising submissive and seeking dominant, it seems like the bedroom has become this safe space for exploring power, working out trauma and I mean, isn't that what that whole book, 50 Shades of Rape, is about?
Well, I think it's, yeah, it's a good counterpoint, because that's, it's very debatable about whether anyone's working out their trauma that way.
Like right, or just indulging in their...
Yes, exactly. It's a paraphilia that is sourced in trauma, and if you enjoy your paraphilia, then you just want to enjoy it. You just want to find circumstances that feed it and that justify it at the same time. So, but of course, that could lead to a healing, because one has the opportunity to see the roots of something if one is going deep into it. But I'd say, in most cases, it doesn't, and it's more likely to backfire than not. And this is speaking personally, as like I did consciously try and explore my trauma in a safe space of the bedroom, and it backfired horribly. Mm-mm. So, I mean, that's something I could testify to at some point. This is an area in my life that I have kept. You know, people think that I lay it all out, but I don't. I keep a lot of stuff private because I consider it private, and that's specifically around my sex life. Although I will refer to it, and I make no secret that it's fraught, and you know, occasionally a desert. But beyond that, you know, I don't, obviously don't, because it involves someone else primarily, not because I'm embarrassed about it per se. You know, this does intersect with neurodeviance as well. Like by the time it gets to the Kubrickon, which is, you know, two books later, but presumably it's in there already. Maybe it's in the first book that you read, I'm not sure. Certainly the notion of psychic enmeshment in the mother, which was in our very first conversation, Big Mother, is central to the whole AI project. Mm-hmm. Like, and also my conversation with Dave, where I said, oh, we're trying to recreate the mother's body.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you get, you've got to get that bit in about plugging in the umbilical cord, and you got to get that in the book.
Yeah, well, it's not just a question of sticking it in somewhere, is it? No pun intended, but of extrapolating more from that, because that was just an idea I had while I was talking to Dave, and he didn't go there, so it didn't go anywhere. So it's kind of,
well, it fits in really well with the Big Mother idea you had, and like I said, why are Siri and Alexa female? You know,
The voices. Yeah, and Her, that movie, Her. Mm-hmm. That's a textbook, whatever, text to study. I dislike the movie, though. I wouldn't want to have to see it again.
Yeah, me too.
But yeah, so, I mean, I haven't exactly finished Kubrickon. I certainly haven't finished Neurodeviant, if that's what it's called, the whole thing. And that would be the end of Kubrickon unless I have a fourth book. But where it ends so far, the point it's up to now in the third book, the Kubrickon, is about how the Overlook is the mother's psyche, and Wendy is actually the Overlook in The Shining, that they're the same, essentially.
Go ahead. And
hence the ending of The Shining shows Danny returning to the mother's psychic, the psychic womb of the mother, when, as the, you know, the father is left in the cold, and Danny remains enmeshed with the mother's psyche, and which is the Overlook. Like, the Overlook still has them, and the Overlook is like the mainframe for AI, as in it's this structure that is there to siphon off Danny's psychic energy and to animate itself. So that whole metaphor is central to the whole book, I think, and how it creates and then harvests, exploits neurodeviance to do it. Like, the culture creates the neurodeviance, like in a Philip K. Dick story, to siphon off their energy.
In which Philip K. Dick story?
Well, I was in Minority Report, but that's not exactly. They're not batteries in the Matrix, are they? But there's also the. Is it Time Out of Joint? Is it Regal Gum, the one where he's, this is the precursor to the Truman Show, where they just create that whole surrogate reality for him so that they can tap into his psychic powers and avert nuclear war. There's that one. And then there's Dick's titles are annoying in that way, because they sort of, they don't stick in memory, and they're easy to confuse.
Yeah, and some of them aren't that good, like Martian Time Slip.
Okay. So it was Time Out of Joint. Martian Time Slip is with the autist boy who sucks people into these false realities or subjective realities. So Martian Time Slip, out of Joint, you spice them together, and you've got quite a lot there thematically, and then throw Minority Report in for good measure. But anyway, so this idea that the culture need, like the Matrix, it needs psychic energy of the individuals that inhabit it to maintain itself, and in order to do that, it has to traumatize them.
Yeah, like it has to create a a mechanism for control that has to be based on like a psychic enmeshment with mother.
Right.
It doesn't have to be, I suppose, but it is. And
well, I think because of course we're getting full circle here. At the end, they're plugged in like fetuses into the Matrix, and at the beginning, they're never unplugged from their mother's psyche. You know, although they leave the physical womb, they don't leave the psychic womb. And I think it has to, because the human being is created out of the mother's body as an extension of the mother's body. So that's its primary reality. Mm-hmm. So then any kind of trauma is going to, the point of the trauma is to prevent autonomy or individuation, and if a human being doesn't become autonomous, then it's going to remain an extension of its mother's psyche, because that's all it is before, that's all we are before we become individuals, unless you're going to get metaphysical.
Before birth.
I was a boy in the girl's bathroom. Pushed me to the mirror, and you pulled me through. Mr. Popular, it was pitch dark in the bedroom, except for the glowing lights
of a dozen cigarette cherries. Well, it looks like I'm Mr. Popular tonight. Mr. Popular. Mr. Popular, who the fuck are you? And Mr. Popular makes the scene, he always makes a scene. He's dressed in a grin, but it's wearing thin. Mr. Popular, if anyone asks, Mr. Popular.
Yeah, and I think we could learn a lot. I mean, it could be useful to juxtapose your notes from Uncanny Valley with Neurodeviant as you read it, because yours is a relatively, you know, small scale project that's a personal narrative, first person narrative, testimony of an individual living in this derealized matrix culture.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But the sort of the soft plot that I either discovered or projected onto it, or a bit of both, of is consistent with this, as in your character doesn't know if he's living in a matrix.
Mm-hmm.
Simulated reality, and wants to test it because that's how it feels. He feels derealized, and over time discovers that he's actually it's not the world that's unreal, it's him.
Right. I'm the simulation.
Sorry?
I'm the simulation.
Yeah, well, you could be a physical real, but you're not a human being, whatever. I mean, however it plays out, I mean, of course, if this is something that people don't really get to this point. I don't know if Elon Musk does. If reality were a simulation, then of course we would be simulations too.
Right.
There's no reason to presume that we've got real selves outside the simulation. We could just be code.
Mm-hmm.
Just part of the simulation that's programmed to have thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
But people don't generally go there. It's like, if this is a simulation, then we need to get out.
Well, if you go there, where do you go from there? Because you either accept that there's not, that the value that you had previously placed on the genuine and the authentic is no longer valid, or you end up in the psych ward, you know. What do you do with
the simulated psych ward?
Right.
Yeah, what do you do if you realize that your thoughts that you might be fake, or that the world is fake, are themselves fake? It cancels itself out, which I think is right and good. The whole question of am I real? It's a bit like the statement, life is meaningless. It's a meaningless statement. One can only say that life is meaningful. That's the only statement one can say about this that is meaningful. Because if life is meaningful, then the statement, life is meaningful, is meaningful. But if life is meaningless, then the statement life is meaningless becomes meaningless too. So, so it counts itself out. So it's a bit like that. We acknowledge that if we believe that we're an unreal simulation in an unreal simulation, well, compared to what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's also like, yeah, I feel like a lot of people operate under the statement of bring your own meaning, you know?
Like, yeah.
Come to life, bring your own meaning.
Yeah, that's what it seems to be a shoe-in for. It's not that, it's just that instead of acknowledging some real meaning, what I like and what I prefer is going to be the measure of real.
Right, right. Yeah, and then we get back into that subjective, you know, inability to know anybody else's, to get inside anybody else's head, where, you know, in Neurodeviant, you talk a lot about people's perception, one's individual perception varying from individual to individual, but you know, you also have to factor in ideology and, you know, that I guess that would be part of socialization and kind of what everybody's programmed to see or not see in reality. Also, like when we were talking about where do you go from there of realizing that you're a simulation, feel like that also opens the door to nihilism. Could open that door, and that's something we've talked about a lot. I sort of agree with the idea that nihilism is actually just kind of this defense mechanism, this coping mechanism for living in an unreal world. I guess I'm saying, well, nihilism, you know, where do you go from there? You know, like, where
from that? Well, because I got a lived example of that with my brother, who's
leads to death. It leads to
self-destruction. Yeah, I mean, I think it has to.
So, or, go ahead.
Well, because I mean, so my brother, he was much more conscious than most nihilists, and he, in a certain sense, he wasn't a nihilist. Maybe that's why he self-destroyed, you know, physically rather than in some more subtle way. But he would announce, you know, I passionately believe in nothing. He would put it that way, as in his nihilism wasn't that he didn't believe in anything, it was that he believed in nothing, like capital N.
But he still believed. The word believe is in there.
Yeah. That's my point, yeah. So that we have to believe. Mm-hmm. In order to act, we have to believe. And like we're sort of talking around now, I keep coming back to the whole question of meaning demands that there is meaning. Like if you question meaning, you're acknowledging that there is meaning, because the only context within which to question whether something's meaningful or not is meaning. Mm-hmm. I mean, the whole context for asking questions is meaning. I mean, nothing, there's nothing without meaning. So then nihilism is like, it starts out as trying to negate meaning, but because you can't, it's the nature abhors a vacuum thing, because you can't negate meaning without mm-hmm. negating yourself, without negating consciousness itself, then you assign all meaning to nothing, to a negation. Mm-hmm. What becomes meaningful is to negate meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it definitely feels like we're moving out of the era of nihilism, it feels like, right? Because that was very much a 20th century thing. And now, and you could even just say that simulation theory, it's a religion that works for science, right? You know, it's a religion that makes sense for science.
How does it make sense?
In that it's there are like rules of evidence that can be that the scientific method could kind of be applied.
So this is back to notes again then. It's like if your character sets out to prove,
to test it, yeah,
that he's in a simulation, he ends up by negating himself.
Uh-oh.
I mean, it's quite tidy as a formula. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't literally destroy himself. It's based on you. But he might reach the point where he has some kind of breakdown or breakthrough because of having to see something about himself, which is he's not who he thinks he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like within the context of a scientific mindset or even culture, just say the culture that we're in, which, and this is where I'd say that nihilism hasn't phased out, it's transmuted into super egoism maybe. But if you negate everything else, then all that you're left with is your own power to negate, which is the ego. And then that becomes king. So, but what was I about to say about notes, about your character? Within the culture, within the context of the culture, if he's not willing to believe in the culture, the simulation, and let it tell him who he is, to quote the Matrix again, then he ends up being a void, like a replicant who just recognizes, oh, I was just created by culture to, yeah, you know, to imbibe the culture and fuel the culture, and that's unreal. So then he'd have this crisis of seeing himself as a replicant or a zombie or a bit of both.
I'm trying to think because, you know, it's interesting because you responded so much more to the action pieces than the think pieces in the book.
Yeah.
We're saying action pieces meaning...
Not a vehicle for Bruce Willis.
you know, interactions with people and daily encounters and life. But I'm thinking about that because I'm thinking, well, in the book, the evidence that he is a replicant, if you like, that the evidence that he collects, it's mostly based on that he decides that the symptoms of depersonalization that he's experiencing could be glitches in his programming, right? he's supposed to have a human experience and human memories, but because it never quite feels real or right to him, that could, you know, it's like there's a problem with the manufacturing, you know, right? There's a problem with you know you're watching a movie if there are scratches on the film, or, you know,
mm-hmm.
the flaws and imperfections, right? Which is also like people say it's our imperfections that make us human. So, but where was I going? I'm trying to think of, is there a type of evidence that could be based less on like a philosophical search or journey and more on action-based evidence, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in Philip K. Dick, I think that didn't he write an early story where a person, I think maybe opens their chest or something and discovers there's a tape, a reel-to-reel machine that's you know, dictating the pre-programmed path that that individual is on, you know?
Right. Well, you're operating at a much subtler level, and you don't
right.
you don't actually want to fictionalize. I mean, whatever, you're prepared to, but you, if you're going to do it, it has to be organic. You don't want to just start introducing science fiction tropes in there, or,
yeah,
you know, going into melodrama. You want it to still be on consistent with the tone and the style of it so far. So it would be, even if you do fictionalize it, would be in subtle ways, I imagine. And I mean, I think that just about every interaction that you write in there, and I assume that this is conscious to some degree, is illustrating something specific. Yeah, something is off in this character's ability to interact with other human beings.
Right. And vice versa, often, you know, there's something wrong with the world, you know.
Yeah, it's not either or, for sure. So it wouldn't have to be, you know, I laid out that plot line in a, to make it simple as a single line, but it wouldn't necessarily have to be as straightforward as an either or thing. He could realize he's a replicant simultaneously with realizing that he's surrounded by replicants. He doesn't have to be the only one by any means.
Yeah.
That would still make it a different kind of simulation than initially he was thinking. But yeah, I just think I think it's already there in many of the encounters, in that they do seem to be little blueprints of mm-hmm. almost like philosophical blueprints.
Yeah, for some reason I'm instinctively thinking of a particular piece as you said those, you know, I like the challenge of this idea of, in the last section of the book, trying to link that internal monologue more with the action pieces, somehow merge the thought pieces and the action pieces in a better way. And I thought about it literally with the example of, I wrote about a couple experiences, you know, when you're walking down the street and there's a street person, a homeless person who is maybe schizophrenic, but they're talking and they start saying things that have some direct connection to what you were just thinking or whatever.
Yeah.
I guess that's almost a little too easy, but it's also like, the way I have written about it already, it's almost just implying, yeah, what does that imply? What is that evidence of? And, you know, the first thing that you think is that there's some sort of radio signal happening, some kind of collective unconscious that person has an antenna for, you know?
Don't try for a felony.
The end of the first part of this conversation. The second part is available at the same place you found this part. This is The Liminalist, the podcast between, at horticulture.com.
12,000 roses, daffodils, just striking poses to compliment malevolent quips. Says the headstone, get off my fool ships. holes in my shoes. He sent someone I've never seen. He says it's running keeps him lean. He walks the wide avenues like it's the alleys of Beirut. He says he writes for magazines, doesn't care what it is you believe. He looks behind him on the streets, avoids the manholes with his feet. He stays in public when we meet. Says he'll soon be off for good. Remember me, it's your old friend. He says he can't quite remember when. Was it in Laos or was it in perhaps Tuileries? Yes, Les Jardins. He wears a white linen suit, and I've got holes in my shoes. He sent someone I've never seen. He says it's